Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Computer Weekly Downtime Upload Podcast. I'm Cliff Saran and my guest today is Prem Anathakrishnan from Accenture. Today's conversation is all about software licensing. So Prem, thank you for joining me today. And may I start with the first obvious question, if that's okay. Yeah. What are the main types of software licensing? And perhaps you may want to introduce yourself as well so we know who you are.
For sure. Hi, Cliff. First of all, thanks for having me. I'm Prem Anathakrishnan. I lead the global software practice at Accenture. And what that means is I support our software clients, some of the leading players out there in terms of serving them and helping them with various different challenges across their value chain. Now, this could be anything from product-related questions or servicing or go-to-market, or in many cases, it comes down to pricing as well. And, you know, with that, you know, if you think about the various types of software licensing, to get to your question, there are, broadly speaking, four pricing models that we see out there in the market. The oldest one is what we call as the perpetual licensing model. This is where, you know, as a client would pay like a one-time fee for the software and own that version forever. This model has been rapidly declining. We kind of see this in less than 10% of, you know, roughly less than 10% adoption out there. Yes. And even when we see this flavor these days, it's mostly seen in software applications that are highly regulated or, you know, in complex industries like industrials.
It tends to be associated, I guess, with on-premise or software.
Also very commonly associated with on-premise software. And as I said, not seen a lot because a lot of software vendors over the last two decades have been transitioning rapidly out of this model into the next model, which is the second one, which is called the subscription model, or also popularly called as the SaaS model. This is the dominant model today with most leading software companies, where customers pay a recurring fee. This could be a per user or per tier for a given term. And the reason that a lot of customers like it, our software vendors like it, and their customers like it, is because this model is predictable, and it allows them to actually, you know, have a way in which they can extract value on a fixed term basis. You know, when you look at it from an annual revenue recognition perspective, the finance teams love it, so the vendors love it. Customers also like the predictability that they can spend on the software, you know, on a recurring basis and budget for it and plan for it.
But just to stop you there for a second, Prem. Yeah. I mean, it does shift, and I'm not sure if you're seeing this both on the customer side and on the IT vendor side, but it does shift the way these things are procured from CapEx to you know, an operating expense. And I guess as a CFO, I'm not a CFO, but I imagine business leaders would look at that as, yes, there's a low starting point, but then whatever you do will then have an ongoing cost.
Indeed, and I think that's why, if you go back like two decades ago, there was a lot of resistance when this model showed up as the popular ARR, annual recurring revenue model, or you can call it recurring revenue model or subscription model. But I think what a lot of CFOs quickly realized is it also, though it shifts from CapEx to OpEx, it's also helping them not get locked into software that might end up being shelf life. They also recognize that they can pay, see value, and then continue to incrementally invest in software. And then even the investors for a lot of these public software companies started appreciating the fact that there's a very smooth land and expand motion that can be built, and it makes the software more sticky, and there's a nice recurring revenue stream, which actually helps drive what you typically see as now a lot of companies reporting as cloud ARR or ARR growth.
For our listeners, what does ARR mean?
It means annual recurring revenue. So when you actually sell software in this subscription model, you basically can actually, let's say it's a 3-year term. what ends up happening is you may book it for a 3-year term, but you actually recognize revenue only for the yearly basis, depending on how the software is basically sold and structured. So, and that annual recurring revenue is kind of a forward-looking view for generally, it's a very common, popular software metric now. So people look at that just to see what kind of growth are you seeing on back of that software for a software vendor.
Thank you.
So moving on, kind of these are two of the perpetual model and the subscription model. I would say if you kind of look back, you can say a vast majority of software vendors today, again broadly speaking, sit in those two models. Mm-hmm. Then the two newer emerging models that have shown up in the last, I would say, decade or so. The one, I'll start with the first one because it is a little bit, it's been adopted to a decent degree, which is the usage-based or the consumption-based model. Sometimes also there's a flavor of this also called the credit model, where people can actually buy these units of usage in terms of consumption credits and continue to use them. This model, in this case, you pay actually for what you use, kind of think of like the cell phone type plans, which are pretty well known there. And this model in some ways was popularized by the cloud and hyperscalers. So it kind of became popular during the cloud era in the last decade or so. And a lot of the hyperscalers middleware software vendors who provide API services, they were the ones who kind of came with this model because the perceived pricing model didn't really reflect the value in terms of how these infrastructure type software applications were trying to position themselves. And this has been growing quite rapidly, especially with the infrastructure software companies and others, until recently when AI has come into the picture, and we'll talk more about that as well. So that's one model. The other thing which I would say I put in the emerging category, which is now becoming a top of mind model, and I say top of mind, not so much from an adoption perspective, but from an interest perspective, is what we're calling as the outcome-based or the value-based pricing models. The idea here is that you pay for the actual results or business impact that the software creates and not just for the access. There's a lot of growing interest in this space, and the ultimate goal, this model is seen as the ultimate goal for AI and agentic software. But we can talk more about that as we go along.
you've mentioned all of the things that I'm going to ask you about now. So I do want to pick up on a small point that you mentioned with the usage model and whether that makes any difference. And that is, with the usage models, like a phone, you can buy a certain number of minutes or you can buy a certain amount of usage. It's a very good analogy, actually. I mean, you do buy minutes a month, don't you, right? So now you can, what they have is sort of buying in advance on the clouds, on the public clouds, they call this reserve instances, right? You know, I mean, there are clearly, there's going to be a cost benefit if they make it attractive to you. But are there risks in doing so in buying upfront as a customer of these potential services?
Yeah, that's a great question, Cliff. I mean, there are, and vendors have come up with very creative flavors of these usage models in order to offset some of those risks and make things a little bit more palatable for the buyers. Mm-hmm. So let's start with some of the nuances of the usage model, right? There's the classic pay-as-you-go, model, which is also a usage model. But in this case, there's no upfront buying kind of a concept, right? So you kind of pay, and if your usage level increases, then you actually go buy more according to that. The problem with this, while that works for a certain type of customers who may want to test and see what their actual usage patterns are going to be, it's really great. And the flip side of that is the CFO problem, right? It's hard for them to project at least a year worth out or 2 years of usage and invest upfront. And then get some of the benefits. From a vendor perspective, this is also a little difficult to predict usage. So they're also not able to kind of make the appropriate investments needed and also, get the right kind of larger value or deals on the table.
Okay.
So what ended up happening is we saw another flavor of this usage model. There are different names people use it for. Sometimes people call it commit to consume or they call it like consumption model with a commitment, upfront commitment or reservation, as you mentioned. That flavor has definitely been widely adopted by some of the larger and buyers because easier for procurement to plan, and still you have like a time aspect to this. The other reason why this is important is because when you do revenue recognition and reporting, it's a lot more easier to recognize on a per term basis. And then there are, in order to make it, some of the points you raised, like risk, and to make it more digestible for the end customers, there are different things that vendors have done to make it more attractive. Like, what if you don't consume everything that you committed to within a given term? You can actually have some parts of that usage, just like in the cell phone plan, you had like overages, or you can actually have kind of like, you know, a cumulative thing, which is a rollover concept. Mm-hmm. Yes. So some vendors, they implement a rollover concept, maybe not for all of the usage, but for part of that usage. So that's one way in which people have actually managed that type of risk. And a lot of times what ends up happening is you may end up committing to a certain usage. And then let's say your usage is more than anticipated, then the vendor and the buyer, they can sit down and negotiate and say, well, we're seeing a different type of usage pattern. Let's do a true up. And then maybe you level set on a new baseline. So there are different creative approaches people have taken with this usage-based models.
So now, I mean, going back to something you mentioned when answering this question, but you know, why is there a shift in software licensing? And I mean, this is touching on what you mentioned about the value-based licensing.
Yeah, first of all, this shift that we're seeing right now is not completely new. So let's start with that, right? And I'll explain where the shift is coming from a mindset perspective, which is a big one, which is more AI-driven. But even if you go back before AI came into the picture, back to the cloud era, the shift away from seat-based term-based pricing, like the subscription pricing, towards something more like a usage or consumption pricing started back then, when you had these hyperscalers and the middleware API vendors, the infrastructure software companies came along. They all needed, a lot of them were targeting developers, right? And the usage patterns were highly correlated to cost and value, where it was like data stored, how can we think about compute and how compute gets used? And then the value gain was much more attributable towards a usage-based model. Mm-hmm. So that shift started happening, but it was not really catalyzed or, you know, accelerated in a big way until AI came to the scene. And when AI came to the scene, you know, back to the ChatGPT moment in 2022, I think people quickly realized, first with Gen AI and now with agentic AI, that AI makes software dynamic, right? Unlike your traditional software where the value sits in dashboards and reports, if it's agentic AI and AI, software is smart, it thinks, it acts, it reasons, and it consumes compute in real time. It's unpredictable in some ways. So you can't price something that dynamic with a static seat license.
So it's changing software licensing. AI is changing software licensing. 100%.
It's catalyzing, in my view, it's changing. So it's changing and driving two things. One is it is definitely catalyzing, it's pouring jet fuel on that trend that was a little passive on moving towards usage-based pricing. But that usage-based pricing is only a proxy for value, because I think that was the known way, or that is still the known way of pricing. The big thing here, the big shift here is like a fundamental change from understanding that software cannot just be purchased as a tool, but how do you think about software as a collaborator that's driving an outcome for the business? Mm. And that is the next shift, I think, is pushing it beyond just consumption pricing to value-based pricing.
If you look at the licensing model of the big generative AI tools, you know, they all have this concept of a token, which to me sounds like a usage-based model that is linked to value. Well, we've got your perspective on that.
Yeah, so I honestly think, so the tokenization or using computing credits or GPU credits, these are all just proxies for value. Mm. It's not the value itself. And I think that there are strong reasons why most vendors have gravitated towards that, including some of the popular AI native vendors. And that's because that's the easiest way to be able to measure and provide a simple way for customers to understand value today. Mm-hmm. And why is that? That's because of a couple of reasons, right? One is truly understanding the value points and attributing the value generated by software to that particular value, and measuring it is a very, very hard problem to solve. And most companies do not have the time nor the operational capability to be able to do that. So time to market has become one of the top reasons. I actually spoke with a client even 2 weeks ago who told me, hey, we would have loved to do a value-based pricing because it could be so cool and disruptive. But the reality is it's going to take us a long time to do that. We need to figure out where exactly value is, agree on that value with our end client, customers, the buyers, then figure out a way to jointly measure that value and attribute everything that we are doing in the software to that. And we need the operating capabilities, right? The infrastructure, the metering, all of that to be able to do it. And we don't have that. So from a time to market perspective, you know, just latching on to a compute credit or some kind of an AI credit seemed like the most simple and easy thing to do at this point. So I think a lot of what we are seeing right now are basically vendors basically providing some kind of an AI credit model, maybe a hybrid model with seat-based plus an AI credit. And I personally think it's a temporary thing, meaning it will still be there for a few years, but I think the long game or the end game is a true value or outcome-based pricing model, especially for AI as agentic takes a bigger role in the picture.
I mean, I know, and I can't remember the story because it's many, many moons ago, but there was... I mean, this idea of value-based or a payment based on how much business the software generates. I mean, you have things that were measuring API calls and things like that. So this is old school sort of enterprise software, ERP systems and the like. And, you know, one of the problems that companies face is that, you know, these are buyers, that often the people who were making these deals were not directly in the business themselves. They were technologists and procurement as well. You know,
procurement.
I mean, I can see that there's going to be some friction going on. So there's going to be a bit a difficulty, a challenge, unless people at the very top of the company are involved, because it's their strategy. You know, if they want to achieve some business objective, and that requires a bit of AI to do so, or a lot of AI to do so, they need to be able to provide, you know, that input.
Spot on. I mean, Cliff, I think one great thing about AI is some of those top people that you mentioned are pretty actively involved. AI is no longer just a procurement or an IT conversation, right? It's definitely a big C-suite conversation in terms of whether that is how you enable your organization through AI or whether you're actually selling AI solutions to the market. Either way, this is a very, very strategic conversation. So I kind of see this like the cloud moment or the internet moment, like where a lot of people are reimagining how they will rethink their entire business model with AI. And that will drive this whole trend towards, are we truly generating value and are we capturing value truly when we sell for the vendors, when they actually are releasing AI solutions to the market? The reality is, if you go back to just 12 months ago, a lot of what was out there was Gen AI, and most capabilities that were released were incremental features, like on top of existing products. So that didn't force somebody to really reimagine like the business model and the revenue model. However, as the investments are getting bigger, people are investing in massive agentic AI type capabilities, the question on monetization is really coming up a lot more. It's like, hey, is this the true way to monetize this? Are we truly capturing value? Because we're investing a lot, right? There's a lot of dollars going into inferencing, massive amount of dollars being spent on compute, you know, all kinds of modeling. So the margins are not easy to maintain, right? So vendors need a way to price dynamically without losing margin predictability. And that pressure is forcing them, I mean, to think about how do we really think about a different way to monetize this? And I think this is why we're going to see a lot of rapid changes in pricing models. And we've already seen it in the industry. Just in the last 6 months, a lot of the larger players have revamped pricing models that they put in the market. So I think the other piece that's important here, as we are talking to clients, we always tell them, be ready to be super adaptable and flexible over the next 2 years to embrace all kind of flavors of these pricing models, because you're going to do a lot of experimentation and see what works and then land on something until the industry converges on some kind of a standardized blueprint for agentic and AI pricing.
I mean, just some final thoughts, really. I mean, Computer Weekly's listeners and readers are IT decision makers, and some will have a job title like IT director or CIO or chief technology officer, but they're sort of leading the technology strategy. And in the past, they would have been the people who set the strategy for things like, you know, which enterprise software to use, which ERP, which middleware and which database platform many, many years ago. Just in a few thoughts, if you may, Prem, can you share with our audience on how they should be considering value-based pricing?
Yeah, so first of all, I'll say, think about a big mindset change and shift, right? In my view, IT buyers need to evolve from a procurement thinking to performance design thinking. Don't think about buying software anymore. Think about how you're hiring digital teammates. That itself is a huge mindset shift. And frankly, all of us in the industry are adapting to that mindset shift, because we still see software as procuring a tool. We need to think about procuring a collaboration vehicle, like whether you think about it as digital teammates or collaboration partners. So that I think is a huge change in terms of thinking that needs to happen. So that would be, like, I would say, broader guideline number one. Now, within that, I would say some more obvious tactical things, or maybe not so obvious, but tactical things. Don't wait for the perfect outcome licensing, right? I mean, so first of all, I think it's important to understand that the credits, AI credits, or consumption pricing, or some kind of a hybrid, is kind of the bridge to a larger path, which is going to be the outcome-based pricing model and value-based pricing model. It's coming at some point. It is going to be there. We just don't know when. It could be a few years. But I think it's important to at least start imbibing some of the tenets for that. So a few things come to mind in terms of actions and tactical things that IT buyers can start actioning and thinking about. One is, start instrumenting some of those outcomes right now, right? So even if the vendors are selling credit models and that's your standard vehicle, but think about tracking those metrics that are still going to be outcome driven, right? What are those business impact metrics? What are those ROIs tied to those credit models, so that you can actually start instrumenting that in your process?
Yes.
So that's one. The second thing is, negotiate hybrid contracts if possible. So when they're negotiating contracts, like, a lot of clients are still going back to the old ways, right? Or can we just do a general contract, time and material, that type of stuff. We always encourage our clients to say, think about outcome-based models. Even if you have a credit-based, usage-based, can you partially or layer some outcome-based clauses?
Yes.
Example, 10,000 credits, but if outcome X is met, we can actually add a bonus on top of it, right? So actually start implementing stuff like that. The other big one I'll quickly call out is also building AI analytics fluency in different parts of the organization, especially procurement, but also within IT, right? Understanding, like, the language, the tools to reason, how do you think about the risk versus return in a probabilistic environment versus a very deterministic environment in the past is super important for leaders and buyers who are trying to procure software going forward.
Yeah. Well, Prem, you've given us a lot to think about. So thank you ever so much for taking part in today's podcast. And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.